Miles Harris, creator of the Miles Harris Macro Vigilance and Economic History YouTube channel. Welcome to the Competent Investor.
Oh, thanks for having me on, Tom.
You know, Miles, I've been trying to move away from asking people how they are, and in this case, I think it is warranted. You and I have had many interactions over the last, let's say, 5, 6 years here, and it's really great to see you back, to see you producing content again, to see that you're still with us. And you know, from the bottom of my heart, I want to, you know, express my gratitude for that, because you're an important educator in this space, alongside many of us, and it's good to see that you're being able to be back, warning people and producing content that is really important.
Oh, thanks, Tom. It's certainly wonderful to be healthy again. It really is. So I'm immensely grateful for that. Immensely grateful.
Absolutely. So, Miles, I think a good place to start today is to give people an overview of this move towards increasing digitalization of our financial system. And I think the right place here is to understand how stablecoins work and kind of breaking those apart as well. So let's start with kind of the US's move into stablecoins, how that maybe creates new demand for US debt, and then we can kind of break apart different stablecoins after that.
Okay, so when it comes to US stablecoin, I think it just helps you understand the actual architecture and the way in which they're actually minted or created. So what happens there is you deposit money with a stablecoin issuer, and they will then take that money and buy an equal amount of US short-term treasury bills. Now, they will then mint an equivalent amount of currency, which will then be issued to you as a stablecoin. So that's the actual architecture there. Now, what's so important there is that the stablecoin provider actually holds the asset. That is the actual short-term treasury bill. So it means the stablecoin provider takes the actual treasury bill yield. So that could be a yield of, say, 4, 4.5% or so. And they then collect that yield. You've just got the token or the actual stablecoin. Now you can use that, of course, as a medium of exchange. But the point there really is that they are taking a public debt stream and they are therefore turning it into a private revenue stream. Meanwhile, you become a proxy holder of government debt. So that's the nature of them. Now, when it comes to the regulated Genius Act stablecoins, you're not able to actually get a yield with the primary issuer. So that again is a really interesting dynamic. So it means you cannot obtain interest on that actual stablecoin account. You've got to go elsewhere and find a secondary provider. What's really profound there is that you could then end up buying a tokenized treasury, perhaps. And as you buy a tokenized treasury, just to hold your money safely and collect a yield on that stable coin, then you've almost doubled the demand. Well, you have doubled the demand for treasuries. So that's absolutely enormous. That you've then actually increased the demand significantly for treasuries. You could also have bought another stable coin elsewhere, and again, that reinforces the demand for US debt. So it's ultimately helping to finance and roll over the exponential growth of the US debt level, which we're all very aware of. It's a very, very clever strategy. And what's also been taking place over the last couple of years has been a process of quantitative tightening, where central banks globally have been getting rid of their sovereign debt. And the dynamic here is Profound, I believe, because on one hand you've got central banks offloading their sovereign debt risk, and you've got the public therefore taking on more sovereign debt risk. Now you could say, okay, right, but isn't the private company also bearing risk? And yes, absolutely, they are. And there isn't the traditional backstop of lender of last resort that exists with the Fed. So no private issuer receives those same sort of deposit guarantees that you'd get in a regulated bank. So I find that all very, very interesting, because I believe that there's a desire ultimately for central banks to clean their balance sheets. And Larry Fink of BlackRock has referred to that process of unlocking private capital. And I believe stablecoins are one key way of doing it.
So, Miles, when we think about how, where this demand is coming from, you said it perfectly, that unlocking private capital. And we kind of put this in this in the same equation as the move away from, let's say, the BRICS countries and their move away from the dollar, the de-dollarizational process that they're going through. How do you think that balances out for demand, aggregate demand for the US dollar ultimately? Because it seems to me that if you're using a newer or you're moving away from dollars for international trade, that seems to be a in my mind, that is a far bigger side of the equation than the amount of private investment or private funding that comes into USD from the stablecoin side.
I think obviously time will tell according to how great the actual demand is for US stablecoins. But I think there's likely to be a number of things that takes place there and really has a big impact on that. And that is firstly, these private companies are greatly incentivized to offer stablecoins. And ensure that there is lots and lots of demand, because it will be so profitable for them to do so. Now, the stablecoin model has high fixed costs to actually set it up, so the startup costs are very, very high. But thereafter, the variable costs are very, very low. So it means that profit per employee, I don't know whether you've ever seen the profit per employee for Tether. It is absolutely enormous, and just dwarfs any other company like Nvidia. So there is an enormous profit incentive for private companies to really sell this very, very aggressively. I think if you are in Latin America, or if you are in certain African countries, again, there's likely to be heavy demand. And I think most of this demand is going to come from private households, of course, as well as private sector businesses in these economies, who may already have a decent reliance upon dollars. And I think the impact on dollar cash overseas is another interesting angle on this as well, because, of course, digital dollars overseas, or some digital stable coins, will be much easier to hold. They'll be apparently more secure, and all these other reassurances that we're provided for them. So I think they are going to be sold very, very heavily. But I think what we're also seeing is the erection of these different blocks. It's almost like different districts, akin to sort of Hunger Games style environment almost, where you've got the sort of BRICS blocks, you've got the European blocks. We've seen the digital euro program initiative launched by Lagarde recently, and then the UK. There's a lot taking place there. So the primary focus seems to be Latin America and the African countries. And I think what that's likely to do. It's certain African countries, by the way. What that's likely to do is to remove a degree of their bank deposits as well and put them into US stablecoins. And what that will equate to will be a loss of sovereignty over monetary policy for the local central bank, as well as less ability to actually step in the midst of a crisis, because you won't just be dealing with your own domestic currency, and so they won't necessarily be able to function in their role as a sort of central bank. So I think the risks then really grow enormously.
Yeah, it seems like there's a move out of those local currencies into USD, and as you said, it provides a new risk for those central banks and their ability to function within that local environment.
Yes, it certainly does. And I'd extend that as well to the actual citizens as well holding stable coins as well. I've previously referred to this potential stable coin supernova. So if you just imagine a scenario where demand is very, very high for stable coins, well, that will help to actually bring down yields on US Treasuries. By bringing down yields, then the government in some ways is actually incentivized to spend more money. As they spend more, then of course the supply of these stable coins can continue to grow. And when they really hit a kind of saturation point, and obviously we're a very, very long way from that, I'm talking sort of 10, 15 years hence, really, then you reach that saturation point, and the debts become so enormous that the actual collateral, the US Treasury, then becomes an increasing risk vector, because people will increase, or people could increasingly be like, well, this is completely unsustainable. I don't want to hold US dollars at the moment. And if there's a global rush towards the exit, then of course that threatens the stable coin peg, and that really could be an enormous crisis. And that would be at the global retail level.
Miles, of course, a company like Tether, as I have looked at, doesn't just hold treasuries. They hold even some physical gold. So how does that play into the asset side of what they have on their balance sheet? And if they move more towards, let's say, physical gold or more tangible assets on their balance sheet, does that strengthen the company in a way, or that coin as well?
Well, I think moving more towards assets like gold, and you could also add within that, of course, having Bitcoin as well, it does raise the potential for them to actually increase their profitability markedly. Now, I don't believe that any of the regulated stablecoin providers under the Genius Act will be as profitable as Tether. Tether is a little bit of an anomaly there because it's unregulated, it's offshore, but I think it still plays a very, very important role in all of this, because if you do have stable coins with the US regulated stable coins, then you may well be parking them elsewhere, and that could involve Tether. It also means that Tether is going to increasingly offer tokenized gold as well. And Tether really does help reaffirm the demand for US Treasuries, but it also is increasingly capturing more of the available gold supply, alongside central banks, of course.
And as I understand it, some of these stable coins that are kind of popping up out of the wake of the Genius Act seem to be regulated and legislated in order or in a way that they are required to only buy treasuries. Is that correct?
Yes, that's right. Yeah. So that is their intention, really, to find more sources of absorption for treasuries. And so the more they can encourage people to actually hold these stable coins and use these stable coins, then the more they will do so. And so, for instance, there's trials taking place with credit cards, stable coin credit cards in Latin America, Visa, MasterCard. They have they call it, I think it's called VTAP Visa. So it's the Visa tokenized assets, something or other. And so all of these companies are shifting heavily towards stable coins because I think the idea is that they are going to proliferate. And ultimately, what we're looking at then is a redistribution of who holds the sovereign debt risk.
Miles, what are some of the differences, let's say, between some of these stable coins? Of course, we've got something like Tether USDT, right? And the UK is just rolling out their new sterling stable coin. So how is that different from Tether?
Yeah, so there's a lot going on with the UK because the UK and the Eurozone are very much playing into this notion of a single unified ledger. Now, a single unified ledger is using distributed ledger technology, which ultimately means that in the current way that the banking sector works, each separate bank has its own ledger. But with distributed ledger technology, they all become one in essence, which is overseen by the central bank and by the government. Now, that gives unprecedented powers, of course, to the central bank and the government. Now, in the UK, this single unified ledger will consist of tokenized bank deposits, which are basically a digital representation of the money that is in your bank account. It will also consist of central bank money, which was previously illiquid and unavailable to the general public. And it will also have on there tokenized gilts, so that's tokenized government debt. As well as pound stable coins. So it's like this crazy multi-money system, really. And what that guarantees is firstly this notion of the singleness of money. And so the BIS talks about this repeatedly, the singleness of money. And what that ultimately means is that it is all interchangeable. And ultimately, the upshot of that is citizens, businesses won't know whether they hold a stable coin, whether they hold a tokenized deposit, whether they hold central bank money, and so on. Now, that also provides elasticity, which is another term the BIS love to use. And elasticity ultimately means that they can increase or decrease the money supply as and when they like. Those are two key elements. But the final one is the composability, that the composition is all equally interchangeable and interoperable. So you can easily move money from tokenized gilts to stable coins to it doesn't matter. It all, in essence, becomes one. And if you pay someone, you don't know whether you're paying in tokenized gilts or in tokenized deposits or stable coins. And it seems absolutely wild, but I think there's method to the madness here. Of course, there is. And I think one of the reasons is likely to be the City of London Corporation wants to maintain a strategic advantage in terms of settlement and moving towards tokenized asset settlement. That's my hunch, and I could be wrong, but that's where my suspicion leads me. And in addition to that, and of course, London's the City of London's history leads me as well. In addition to that, you've also got the stablecoin dynamic, which ultimately means that they can still utilize fintech Now, stablecoins themselves don't fulfill the elasticity function that I just mentioned. So, going back to the US examples, and I'm sorry this is complicated, but it's just the way it is. That a stablecoin provider needs to receive a deposit before it can create and issue the tokens. And so that doesn't provide the elasticity to expand or contract the money supply as if. You've got the central bank overseeing and engaging in the ledger using central bank money. I hope that makes sense.
Well, this is exactly why I wanted to speak with you about this, Miles, is because it is a very complex thing. And as you're explaining this, it just makes me think the addition of complexity and centralization to any monetary system, to me, makes me very suspicious.
Completely. And again, what we're seeing is the ability of the central bank, because the Bank of England has been offloading gilts. It was flooding the gilt market. If you think back to what happened with Liz Truss, the Bank of England played quite a major role in that. If you look at their balance sheet, you'll see that, and their gilt holdings. And again, they're finding more means to actually offload all of that sovereign debt. So the theme repeats. And what's also interesting about this is that all of these systems increase the feasibility of UBI as well.
So the ability of them to be able to distribute UBI, or the ease of use as well.
Both. Yes, I think ultimately, such enormous debt loads, and this is counterintuitive, really, but such enormous debt loads make UBI payments almost a necessity, because how do they keep solving the situation of debt problems? Well, their answer to everything, as we've seen with Trump, talking about 50-year mortgages, it's always more debt. So, debt is liquidity, and therefore, they want to increase debt levels. And UBI is one means of doing that. And so, by having a system that you can actually distribute the money and then back it by government debt, so it means that you're basically holding tokens that are government debt. And of course, then they'll skim a bit off each transaction using the programmability element, and that will go in towards paying interest payments on that debt.
It just really seems like this is another symptom of this insane debt system that can't shrink without collapsing, right?
That's
The
it.
solution to the debt problem that we have currently is just more debt.
That's right. That's all they're doing. That's all they're offering. And further abstraction, further centralization of money. And yeah, as you said, adding to the complexity all of the time. And I think that's very, very interesting. I also find it very interesting that the BIS has written in the last 5 years a couple of papers on the Bank of Amsterdam as well. Because the Bank of Amsterdam was the original stablecoin. And so it's almost history just rebranding once again, not necessarily repeating or repeating in a digital format, but it's evolving into this system where risks really are converging upon the public at large. And that's my major concern, really.
So, Miles, when we're using this term of tokenization, let's define that a little bit and give some different examples of it. I think it's really important to understand as well, and what that actually means when you're talking about, let's say, the difference between a tokenized debt instrument versus, a tokenized gold bar or coin.
Yeah, okay. So tokenization is essentially a digital representation of an asset. And then that asset can be split down into fractional parts. So that's the nature of tokenization. But I think one of the most important elements of tokenization is that it really just ensures that everything is taking place upon the same shared monetary pipeline and messaging system. And that is the ISO 20022 system, which is an upgrade from the previous financial messaging standard, and is much needed to improve sort of cross-border speed and to also reduce costs in cross-border transactions. But what it also enables is what's known as rich metadata, and that can include the digital identity, the know your customer information, anti-money laundering. It will also include information about the tokens themselves. So the tokens consist of both information and rules. So the information will be what the actual asset is, who has owned it, and this is all stored on a blockchain ledger, which of course will be communicated via the pipeline too. When you're dealing with tokenized deposits, you're dealing with a medium of exchange with a memory in essence. So it's not fungible money in the way that cash is, because you don't know the history of cash, whereas the history will be fully known of every tokenized asset. And it will also include rules as well. And so the rules will enable smart contract use. Which could include like payment on delivery, for instance. So if you've ordered something online where you don't actually pay until it's arrived, so it could function along those lines. It will also, in all likelihood, of course, have these kind of carbon scoring metrics attached as well. And that's of course another interesting angle. When it comes to tokenized deposits, they're liabilities on the bank, so they are bank liabilities. When it comes to tokenized gold, then of course you are said to hold that asset, but of course the custodian will hold the asset, and you are then subject to terms of service changes, as well as trust in that custodian who may update the rules and so on. So yes, that's what we're ultimately looking at here within the UK pilot that's going on at the moment for tokenized deposits. They're also using the remortgaging process as a way of experimenting with tokenized mortgages. That is another very interesting area, because it will mean they'll need to digitize the actual titles, and then they'll have to tokenize the mortgages alongside them. So it will mean that if you've got a tokenized mortgage, that you've got to adhere to all of your terms and conditions applied there. And of course, it also means that there's one point of control which potentially can be switched off. It'll be interesting to see what sort of reassurances and safeguards are provided when it comes to things like this.
Well, I mean, the idea of holding or buying tokenized gold to me, when we're talking about physical gold, completely defeats the purpose of holding physical gold, because all you're doing is just adding counterparty risk, and as you said, terms of service to your gold holding.
Yes, that's right. But as we discussed off air, that's what really makes gold acceptable to governments. And I think the fact that we're now seeing all of this central bank buying, yes, okay, it started in 2010, but I think they knew which way the wind was blowing really there. And The increased demand is, of course, partly because of the innovation of the ability to digitize and tokenize this gold as a potential settlement device out in the East. And that does provide it with a very interesting angle. And I think tokenization is one of the driving forces that is actually supporting gold prices as well, because it means that they can effectively capture more gold and record it, put it on databases and track it and surveil it. And of course, the traditional reasons for owning gold then dissipate. And I think if you're a government who's eager for more control, for more tax base and more access to people's private capital, then that does provide that facility. And again, when it comes to tokenized gold, that will all take place through the same monetary pipeline.
Miles, let's kind of break apart, let's say, the way that the East and the West really treat gold and this idea of more central bank buying basically out of the East for the last decade, obviously very much so over the last 4 years. How, for example, is China treating gold recently? I know there was a development that they started, or that they announced that they're going to start paying interest on gold reserves. What do you think that ultimately means for the person who has that asset?
My perspective is somewhat more complex, perhaps more controversial when it comes to the common East West narrative. I've put a video on my channel which is called Multipolar Deception. If you look at that, you'll understand more about my perspective there in the background for that, together with Basel III banking regulations. I believe that what we're ultimately seeing there is a desire to capture both gold and silver and the remaining supply that is actually available in the marketplace. I think that's the long-term intention, because if you are building this digital system, you don't want to have other forms of wealth which aren't easily traceable, which aren't easily trackable. And I don't really look at the central banks as individual entities representing these different sovereignties. I prefer to look at them as perhaps the BIS Committee on the Global Financial System does. So you've got all of the major central banks there, and their senior representatives taking part on this committee on the global financial system at Basel. Of course, the BIS itself is a coordination hub to help ensure that central banks are working along the same lines. They're all plugged into this ISO 20022. So while it appears that we've got this divergence taking place, we've got more and more convergence in terms of the actual digital system that's actually taking shape there. So that is ultimately my perspective, but I do think that they want to use it as a settlement option. So, for instance, the Gulf states, I think they will provide a key role in providing hydrocarbons, providing energy for the global economy. And of course, gold is a key settlement option that can be used, and it's of course one that can circumvent sanctions. So we've seen Russia using it to trade with China, and I think we're going to see more developments along that route. And the East will continue to de-dollarize. I believe that's entirely the intention, but in the West, there's still a great reliance on the dollar digital rails, and there's almost this symbiotic relationship really between China and America, where China produces and America financializes. And they actually kind of fit together perfectly as a result of that. Meanwhile, you've got the Gulf sat in the middle. And I think from that sort of framework, it makes a lot of sense. And then, of course, you've got the emergence of India and what's taking place there. And if you then extend that and look at silver, 50 to 60% of industrial demand for silver comes, sorry, from 50 to 60% of demand for silver comes from industry. And so, as such, what are the major sources of that? Well, of course, a lot of it is renewables, and much of this demand for silver is therefore being driven, and the price of silver is actually being driven by the West, but it's been accumulated in the East. So the West wants it as a final value-added product. The East adds value to it as the production hub of the world, and that's true of India increasingly and China.
So going back to this this example specifically of China offering interest on gold deposits, do you think it makes a difference if they're paying it in yuan versus paying that interest in more gold? Does that change, let's say, the incentive structure of trying to, in a way, get gold into the system out of, let's say, private hands?
Well, it certainly fits that pattern, doesn't it? So if you want to actually encourage people to deposit their gold, well, a great way to do that is to actually offer them interest on that gold so that they're actually, and of course that's a major flaw of holding gold, that it doesn't attain a yield. So it does offer that prospect, and that makes a lot of sense. It certainly fits within the whole sort of state objectives. Was that actually confirmed then, Tom?
I've seen different reports. I find it, so difficult for myself to believe a lot of the information. Like I've seen, let's say, two totally different sides of information being put out around, let's say, the Chinese social credit system, for example. So for myself to, let's say, completely believe to confirm or deny something like that is really difficult, but it's something that I'm working through trying to get a handle on to gain a better understanding of, for sure.
Yes, and of course, one of the gold's weaknesses there is the fact that when it comes to a store of value, you don't actually want to spend it. And so therefore, again, it reinforces that desire to actually place it where somewhere you can attain a yield, that's going to be very significant. Of course, China has long talked about the fact that and encouraged its citizens to hold more gold. Now, I don't personally believe they're doing that for benevolence, really. I think that eventually there's going to be a desire for them to get hold of that gold as well. And therefore, they need to incentivize this. And what we've certainly seen a lot of recently is not out and out force, but just gradualism, incrementalism, just tiny steps moving us towards the overall intended direction. So perhaps that could be part of that. But I personally do believe that there is a need to actually take the physical value out of the financial system and to virtualize it.
Miles, when we're thinking about going back to this idea of tokenization, who do you think is sidestepping it or not willing to go into that system of tokenization of their assets?
I think those that are aware that it's again another abstraction of ownership, really, and that previously in owning a home, it was just really the only barrier really was you and the state, And actually, that can be a very big barrier. And of course, that's not what we'd like to have. But ideally, I think when it comes to why they're actually really driving that and who's resisting it, I think what you've then got to consider when it comes to tokenizing an entire home is that you've then got the actual code becomes almost like the key enforcer. Then you've got the terms of your mortgage. And of course, you needed to continue to make repayments and so on. But you've then also got to think about the owners of that tokenized mortgage as well. And so the complexity again just really accelerates. And that again is just another concern for many people, but most people aren't going to understand all of this. And because if they did, it goes almost back to that Henry Ford quote that for those that understand the system and money, well, they'd be out in the streets tomorrow. So, and it is just that abstraction of ownership again that we're seeing, Tom, and adding the complexity. And adding the rent extraction, the financial rent extraction from this entire process. Because while they promise 24/7 fast payments when it comes to tokenization, you've also got those key parties that will actually be involved and will be disintermediating the smaller players in the marketplace and getting rid of their roles. So whether that be solicitors, whether that be, smaller financial providers, and it's almost like centralization and captured by the big institutions that can really benefit from tokenization.
Well, I
But
know
yeah, go on, sorry.
I was going to say, going through your channel, I think you made a video about the ultra wealthy not kind of moving towards this type of system for most of their assets. Maybe a certain percentage, it makes sense to have that ease of transaction or that increasing the speed of transaction, but ultimately they're actual assets are not going to be held within that system, right? Because they understand it more.
Yes, that's right. So I think that will certainly come into that, and then of course they will use certain loopholes that will remain available to the super wealthy or the super well connected. I think those different avenues will be pursued by those who really have that advantage. But those generally aren't options for the common person, sadly. And so hence, when it comes to the physical wealth that is portable, that is fungible, when, therefore gold and silver, that's another reason which actually increases their desire to ensure that they can track and trace that marketplace. Because yes, you might own a home under a tokenized system, but it's still tied down. You can't move that home. It's easily tracked. It's all of the data and everything is known and understood about that property. So yeah, it's a brave new world really of enormous programmability and surveillability capabilities that we've just never seen before.
Miles, what do you think that gold's role is going to be kind of moving forward in the world's financial system here and currencies? You mentioned this idea that, maybe China's system and the US or the West versus East debate is one in the same in a way. Do you think that the idea that the East is buying more gold and kind of maybe underpinning or moving towards a new currency system of underpinning their currencies with physical gold, especially with the advent of basically China moving towards creating this network of gold vaults through the East. Is there a difference, do you think, in that way that they're moving to financialize gold more so within their system?
Yes, I think so. And I think a lot of that is going to be via tokenized settlement arrangements as well. And so having those different hubs is vitally important. I think if you look at the role of Dubai in providing African gold and African grey gold as well, then that is
What's
another.
gray gold?
Oh, so it's the sort of shadow gold that seems to be emerging, and some of that is coming from conflict zones. Some of it is coming from what's termed illegal or illicit mining, and they've long acted as a key gateway for that. But I think part of the reason for that is because of Eastern demand, whether it's China or India, and that just is really helping to support that trade. And of course, I went to Dubai, what, 25 years ago, and gold was everywhere there in terms of a retail option. So I can imagine it's far more significant now than it's ever been, really. So having these different vault locations across these different countries, having that BRICS bridge path, sorry, the Gulf countries as a key bridge between the BRICS and the West, I think is also very significant. I think, yes, we're going to see increased tokenized settlement, I think, between these different nations, because it's an understandable means to ensure that you continue to de-dollarize ultimately. And that is the goal. And I think if you look at this from the perspective of large central banks, you don't want to be holding all of these dollars and all of this sovereign debt in the West. And therefore, if you want to offload it, how are you going to do that? Well, you're going to do that very, very gradually. You're not going to want to just sell it and collapse the entire market when you're left holding the bag. So they've got to do this very, very gradually, very slowly. And I think that's where all the discussions there that we've had about stablecoins, tokenized deposits, and so on really come in, finding those new absorption systems. But meanwhile, in the West, of course, as official data outlines, the biggest holder of gold is still the US. And so by extension, what you can also see is that it is an insurance for the digital system as well. So it's an insurance and a capture of overall economic value. And I think if they're, as in the central banks and big corporations, the ones left holding the gold, well, those are the groups ultimately who are left holding the real kind of indicator of value for the global economy. Because how else can you really determine value in a digital system? Does that sort of make sense there? Like, because everything has become so abstract, and gold is of course the original sort of money alongside silver there.
Yeah, I think it becomes that the ultimate reference point, right?
Yeah, that's it.
So, Miles, what do you think is the, let's say, the solution to all of these issues? Is it holding physical gold in your possession? And that is, one of the, let's say, not the only, but the one of the best ways to kind of be able to transport some value through this time.
Yeah, I think that's certainly one of the best ways. So holding gold, holding physical silver as well, and like you may hold some tokenized gold and tokenized silver as well. But I think there you've just got to be aware that you're supporting what is the overall capture of the gold and silver market, because I think we're looking at a point where in the not too distant future, there won't ever be gold and silver physically available again, 10, 15 years down the line, because it will all become tokenized and digitized, and the main holders will be those central banks, of course, and therefore it's that desire to actually capture that reference point, as you referred to it. But that also, I think, understanding that also gives you a key advantage there as well, that you recognize the game that's actually being played there. I know Rick Rule recently said that he intended to sell some of his gold and tokenize it. And so that may be a good option, much further down the line, when they start demanding that people hand in their gold, because I think we'll reach that point. And I think the intention is, firstly, to just conduct a de facto revaluation of gold and silver, and by extension, price it out of range for the average person, but also incentivize more sales back into the system.
Right.
And I think that's ultimately what we're looking at, really.
Miles, something you and I spoke about before we hit record here today is kind of this era of fear that we're in, and the versus the reality of the situation on the ground. You know, you're in the UK. Give us some perspective on how you see that. This time, from let's say a psychological perspective of trying to understand exactly as you know, we kind of went through that example earlier of Chinese information, let's say, or our digested version of what we consider to be information out of China. You know, is there far more fear being put out into the world than actually exists? And understanding these risks is the more important part, and then just disconnecting from it.
I think there's certain parts of the world where fear is absolutely understandable for those really struggling in conflict zones, and that's completely recognizable. But and yeah, you can completely understand what's taking place there. But when it comes to life in the UK, as we were saying, yeah. You're aware that things aren't great and things aren't heading in the right direction, but it does become quite difficult because, as we talked about, you know, we've got young children, and therefore they're very grounded with where they are, and very happy, and causing distress or upset and moving right now isn't the right option for us, but it may well be for other people, and I completely understand that. Now, I'm in a very fortunate position, and not all people have that same sort of advantage that I'm so fortunate to have, really. And if I was paying sky high mortgage and all of the rest of that, alongside, you know, the crazy energy prices and the increased rates and so on, then I would completely understand people wanting to move and get out. I think, of course, there's certain areas where you wouldn't want to actually spend too much time, let's put it like that. But where we are, again, being out in the countryside, life's pretty good, really. Life is pretty good. But yes, there are things that really do irk you. So, for instance, you know, price of property, the price of land, these things have been artificially inflated to disadvantage the people, and to enrich the banking system, and that's obviously not good. But yeah, I think you just need to almost just take a holistic approach and just look at things realistically. And if you understand, actually, there's lots of people who are on your side, and you've almost got a little community that can support one another in different areas of expertise, then that counts for quite a bit. The future of the economy itself, of course, looks very grim. And we know that all of this system being built is ultimately for extraction, revenue extraction for taxes. It's about enforcement. It's about behavioral control. So we're aware of all of that, but at the same time, you've just got to enjoy the moment, just live for the moment, and that's what life is about. And in that moment, what do you have to fear right now?
Well, that's the basis of suffering, is it not? Is worrying about what will happen or the continuation of that fear into the future versus being able to remove yourself is being in that moment. I think really understanding the risks, understanding, our food system, our financial system, all of these things, yes, they're under attack. Understand it, do something about it, take action, and then go outside and leave your phone at home and be in that moment, and enjoy what you have while you have it. Because while we are in a very dynamic time and there are a lot of things changing, there is still a lot to be very positive about, a lot to go enjoy, and a lot to be grateful for as well.
Oh, absolutely. And to that end, this could be the actual kick up the backside that humanity actually really needs to actually just go back to basics and be more primal, as we said earlier, off count off air. If we can do those things, that's huge. And certainly what I've learned over the last few years is a Buddhist saying that with subtraction, well, your soul grows. With addition, your ego grows, and it's so much more fulfilling actually to really just take a moment and enjoy your life and enjoy those around you, and just to step away from all of these screens and just get back to nature.
Absolutely. Well, Miles, that was really well said. I appreciate all of your time and walking us through this increasing digitalization of what we're facing here, what we're looking at. Of course, for anybody that wants to see or listen to more of Miles, you have a Substack, milesharris.substack.com, of course on X at Miles Harris LGA, and of course the Miles Harris YouTube channel. Miles, thanks so much for your time today. Always appreciate it and good to see you.
Oh, great. Thanks, Tom.